The story began on Stephen's Green outside the Shelburne Hotel on a spring morning in 2004. I was propping up my old 1970s BMW motorcycle onto its main stand, which I would often use when I went to the city center. Zooming in and out of the city was always easy on a bike, parking never a problem, and the weather rarely an impediment if you wore the right gear. As I was bending down to lock the bike, I felt a tap on the shoulder. Two very respectable-looking middle-aged men in suits were standing next to me. "Apologies for disturbing you," one of them said. "I saw your motorcycle. I was looking for one of those, as I always wanted a big Beamer when I was younger. You wouldn't know if anyone had one of them for sale?" This is how I got to know Brian. Having always been into old motorcycles, I had a couple of them in the shed behind my cottage in the Wicklow Mountains, where I lived. Brian made the trip down to Barn Derrick to see me, and I ended up selling him his dream motorcycle. We stayed in touch. Brian, as it turned out, was a well-connected, high-ranking Irish diplomat, and he had already been working at the United Nations in New York as a young man. His connections in high places became clear when, in late September 2004, my phone rang, and it was Brian. "Listen," he said, "I know you know the Wicklow Mountains quite well." He wasn't wrong. I had moved to Ireland from Germany in 1993 and made a home for myself among the rolling hills of Wicklow. "I have a very prominent visitor coming to Ireland," he continued, "and he would love to see the mountains. Any chance the three of us could go for a walk next week when his official business is concluded? It has to stay confidential, though. He doesn't want to bring his security personnel." I was intrigued and curious and agreed to his proposition, especially when Brian told me who I was going to show around in the Wicklow Mountains, Kofi Annan. There are very few people, let alone politicians, who I have ever been in awe of, but Kofi Annan is among the short list of figures I give that distinction to. I have adored him since he emerged onto the world stage in 1997 as the then General Secretary of the United Nations. In his dignified, calm way, he created a sense of stability for me in the increasingly unstable world of the early 2000s. The following days, I busied myself studying the most detailed maps of the Wicklow Mountains and scouted out my favorite places on my motorbike and on foot to make sure that we could access some spectacular and yet hidden gems in the countryside. Then the big day came. It was a Thursday. Beautiful autumn sunshine. Perfect. I had prepared sandwiches and snacks when, standing at the kettle to prepare a big flask of tea, I felt an unwelcome sensation throughout my body. I had to sit down for a moment. Brian was going to pull up in his car in about an hour's time, and here I was, feeling sicker and sicker by the minute. A glance at the thermometer confirmed my worst fears. I had fever. It was high, and it was sudden, and I knew instantly that there was no way I was up for a walk in the mountains. Moreover, I could not risk giving Kofi Annan my fever. With a heavy heart, I rang Brian on his mobile. They were, of course, on their way to South Wicklow. I was heartbroken, felt totally sick, and most annoyed as well. I was never sick, and then today of all days. Shortly afterwards, I saw Brian's car pulling into my drive. I had left maps, sandwiches, the flask of tea, and detailed instructions outside on a wooden bench. He waved at me through the sitting room window and shrugged his shoulders in compassion. I was, no doubt, a pitiful sight on my chair, wrapped in a warm blanket and feeling like death. Behind Brian, I could see the great man himself, sitting on the passenger seat of the car, looking out at the beautiful rolling hills of the South Wicklow countryside. As they pulled out of my drive, Kofi Annan looked over to my house, saw me, and waved his hand. Then I was alone again. October sunshine flooding into my sitting room and little bits of dust were dancing in the quiet air. The following day, I felt fine again. Brian said they had a lovely day in the mountains. Kofi Annan apparently was enthusiastic about the places he encountered, and he expressed hope that we might try to go for a walk again when he would be over in Ireland the next time. I believe the next time Kofi Annan came to Ireland was in 2014. By then, he was no longer Secretary General of the United Nations. He was in advancing years, and I'm not sure if he would still have been willing to stumble across the soggy soil of the raised bogs of Wicklow. Not that I would have known either way, as Brian had moved to another diplomatic posting and we had lost contact. Kofi Annan died in 2018, aged 80. I never did get to properly meet him, though I did get a personal wave from the great man himself. I wonder if Brian still rides that early 1970s BMW motorcycle.
When I was a teenager in the 1980s, my grandmother came to live with us in the small Midland town we'd moved to after we left the North. All her life she'd lived in Belfast, only to find herself 100 miles from home, a widow lodging in someone else's house. As my sisters and brother and I grew up and her health failed, she seemed to retreat from the everyday goings-on in our house. She took to sitting in one of our gold velour armchairs, the tube of her catheter bag slung over the sleeve of her dressing gown like the straps of a handbag, telling stories of her girlhood. I read somewhere that there was no such thing as teenagers until after the Second World War. My grandmother, Hannah Maguire, grew up in Ardoyne during the 20s. She went to work in a linen mill at 14, yet she and her friends had distinctly teenage preoccupations. They bobbed their hair, scrimped, saved and mended to dress in the flapper style, danced the Charleston and went to the pictures. These interests didn't always sit well with Hannah's mother, a severe woman who'd been left a widow in 1915 when her husband was killed at the front. Hannah was only 7 when she lost her father. Her mother thought the teenage Hannah vain and frothy and rarely missed an opportunity to say so. Hannah's idol was the Italian actor Rudolph Valentino. He was given roles that exploited his dark hair and eyes, his smouldering good looks. He played an Arab sheik, a tango dancer, a French aristocrat, a bullfighter. He dressed in extravagant costumes and gave audiences scene after scene of brooding glances and passionate clutches. Off-screen, he was at the centre of an infamous sex scandal, which only added to his appeal. But in 1926, Valentino died suddenly of peritonitis. My grandmother learned of his death at the pictures from a Pathé newsreel. The headline read, "Valentino dies, thousands throng streets. Fairbanks, Barrymore, carry coffin." The film flickered and jumped, and my grandmother could hardly believe what she was seeing. 100,000 people, mostly women, lined the streets of Manhattan for his funeral. Mounted police had been deployed to corral them away from the funeral home, and the women responded by dragging the officers from their horses. Windows were smashed and the rioting continued well into the night. My grandmother told me that the patrons of the Forum Picture House in Ardoyne, themselves no strangers to civil disorder, were deeply impressed. Valentino's body was laid out on a plinth surrounded by lilies and palms and covered with a heavy cloth embroidered with the letters IHS. "He's a Catholic," someone said, and Rudolph Valentino was one of their own. The Millies clung to each other and cried, their Cupid's bows pursed as tight as the looms they worked, their bobbed hair so full of setting lotion it barely moved. Valentino was dead. Hannah, having lost her father when she was a child, knew what that meant. That she'd think of him every day and that nothing would ever be the same again. Valentino's last film was a big budget epic called Son of the Sheik. It was set not east of Suez, but south of Algiers. Valentino played both the Sheik and his son, and my grandmother couldn't decide which of them she loved the most. Over the following months, she saw the film dozens of times until she knew it by heart. The line that made her cry every time was, "My young lion, your people would gladly pay 10,000 francs to look at your handsome face again." One Saturday in November, Hannah put on her coat, pulled her cloche hat over her ears and went out. She crossed the Crumlin Road to Holy Cross Church and went up the steps. There was a heavy box on a marble table in the hall with a sign pinned to it that said, "November Dead List." She tried to remember the last time she'd seen her father, but his face had long since faded from her memory. All she could see when she tried to conjure up his image was how he looked in the only photograph they had of him that was taken 5 weeks before the telegram came. She took a piece of paper from her pocket and opened it carefully. In her best script she had written, John Maguire, 1881 to 1915. Rudolph Valentino, 1895 to 1926. She had almost put Rifleman in front of her father's name, but thought better of it. Her beloved Valentino needed no introduction. She folded the paper, kissed it quickly, and slipped it into the slot on the top of the box. She whispered goodbye to the two men she had loved and lost and stood with her heart pounding in her chest. When the priest read the names from the altar the next day, her mother would kill her.
Only a very short time ago, I was on holiday with my family in Croatia. We'd never been before and spent lovely days swimming in the clear waters of the Adriatic and pottering around local villages. At some point in the holiday, perhaps around the halfway mark, my daughter, holding my hand as we walked one evening, turned to me and said, "Do you know what makes me really sad? That I won't remember any of this when I'm older, because I'm so young now and people don't remember things from when they're young." I swallowed down the heartbreak of this truth and thought of ways to help her to remember. "You could keep a diary," I suggested, "and we'll have our photographs to remind us." She moved on quickly, as children do, whilst I was left musing on the failings of my own memory. I took out my phone and opened the Notes app, which I often use to write down messages to myself, to take note of things I want to remember. Shopping lists, books to read, ideas for stories. I typed out a list of moments from the holiday that I didn't want to forget. Recently, I looked in the Notes app to read the list again, but I couldn't find it. Earlier in the week, I'd organised the Notes app in an attempt to become the kind of person who uses folders and categories instead of a more scattergun approach. I must have deleted the holiday list. I put my phone down and tried to remember what was on the list. What were the moments from this holiday of only 2 months ago that I desperately wanted to remember? I could almost feel the cogs in my brain turning over and over as I tried to pull the memories to the surface. The sunset swim where the sea was empty as everyone else prepared for dinner. My son silhouetted against the sky, ready to jump in the water off the rocks. But there was more on the list than this. Why couldn't I remember? Because typing out notes on your phone is not the same as remembering. Looking at photographs on your phone is not the same as remembering. From its cloud, my phone trawls its own memory for photographs from the past to present to me at random times. Here is something from 1 week ago. Here is something from 10 years ago. Here is someone you haven't seen for ages. An image pops up of my children from a decade ago. The hair is blonder, the cheeks chubbier. I try and put myself in the image, but I can't. I'm looking at the photograph, but I don't remember the day, what we did after that moment, what was occupying me at that time. Notes and photographs are too real, too sharp. Memories are supposed to be blurred. Stories which have been told over and over in your mind until you aren't sure any longer of the details, or even if they're really true. Memories aren't static notes or images. Memories are alive. I picked up my phone again to look through the Notes app, a chaotic list of things I wanted, at some point, to remember. Magnesium citrate, Nick Laird, Liz Berry, fish oil, Hilary Mantel, call Vinny, call GP, return hockey slip, mouth guard, dentist, boxing academy, Joan Didion, €96, River Barrow, One Grand Parade, Vico, Hera Lindsay Bird. What does it all mean? I once thought it all so important. Eventually, I did find the list, buried deep in another note on my phone, because unlike me, technology never forgets. It's mostly a list of various swims we enjoyed, at sunrise, at sunset, of piers and islands, typical holiday memories. But if I put the phone down now and ignore the list, I can reach into my memory and see us there again, and I can tell myself over and over about the fun we had, splashing in the clear waters under sharp blue skies until I never forget.
Softly, A deep Welsh voice draws us in to a moonless, starless night. In the small fishing side town, its cobble streets silent but for the bare hint of life and love by the slow black, mysterious sea. So opens Dylan Thomas's play for voices, Under Milk Wood. The voices are those of the eccentric inhabitants of an imaginary seaside town in North Wales called Llargub. The idea of a play about such a place had been gestating in the poet's mind for years after a walking trip in 1944, during which he was ferried across the River Taff to the town of Lacarn. Stricken by the strangest town in Wales, he confided to a friend that he could never do justice to the miles and miles of mud and grey sand, the unnerving silence of the fisherwoman, and the mean-souled cries of the gulls. The script had to be dragged out of Thomas. A rough outline took shape in 1947, and 2 years later, a frustrated BBC producer bequeathed the poet and his work in progress to a colleague, Douglas Cleverdon. He cultivated the poet's talent, and 3 years later, after dinner with his wife Kathleen, at Cleverdon's home, Thomas read aloud, for the first time, a sizeable chunk of the script. Overwhelmed by the force of the piece, Cleverdon persuaded the BBC to offer Thomas 5 guineas for every 1,000 words to finish the script, an unprecedented proposal at the time, but to little avail. The producer even invited himself down for a weekend at Thomas's home in Lochearn to spur him on, but it was a fruitless expedition. Thomas entertained his guest in the pub, where they drank pint for pint until well after closing time. Almost another 3 years passed before the script was completed, after a fashion. At the first theatre staging of Under Milk Wood in New York in May 1953, the director had to detain the author in a back room to finish the play, the final, just written scenes being hurriedly copied and delivered to the waiting actors. On a Thursday in October 1953, Thomas delivered the revised script to the BBC to allow copies to be made. The manuscript had to be returned to Thomas by Saturday, as he was due to travel again to New York for further readings. Having collected the original, he then went on a pub crawl. Later that weekend, in a very distressed state, Thomas rang Cleverdon at home. He had lost the manuscript in a taxi or in a pub somewhere. The producer reassured him that copies had been made. On the following Monday, Cleverdon handed 3 copies of Under Milk Wood to a much relieved Thomas at the Victoria Air Terminal in London's Cromwell Road. Over a drink in the lounge before his coach left for the airport, Cleverdon commiserated with Thomas on the loss of the original manuscript, to which the author replied, "If you can find it, you can keep it." He then reeled off the names of some pubs in Soho where he had been drinking. During the following days, Cleverdon scoured London Soho and discovered the original manuscript at the Helvetia Public House in Old Compton Street. Dylan Thomas never learned that his original manuscript had been found. Considering, no doubt, that discretion was the better part of valour, Cleverdon avoided the time and expense of a transatlantic telephone call or a telegram to relay the good news. 2 further staged readings of Under Milk Wood were held at the Kaufman Auditorium in New York over the weekend of the 24th of October 1953, but the author was in poor shape from a combination of strain, sleeping pills and alcohol. On the 5th November, he collapsed at the White Horse Tavern on New York's Hudson Street and died, aged 39, 4 days later. Those 9 words, "If you can find it, you can keep it," gifting the original manuscript of Under Milk Wood to Douglas Cleverdon, became the focal point of an action to recover the manuscript in the High Court of Justice on the Strand in London by the author's widow, Kathleen, a McNamara from Ennistymon in County Clare. 12 years had passed since the author's death. "It is hard enough," commented the judge, Riley, "to remember a conversation one had a week ago, let alone 12 years ago." But Kathleen lost her case. Despite his scepticism of Cleverdon's evidence, the judge relied, although he didn't say so explicitly, on the old adage, possession is 9/10 of the law. After the trial was over, Cleverdon wrote a book on the provenance of this extraordinary play for voices. In it, he discussed the minute differences in the various drafts of the text. He also recounted how, 2 months after the poet's death, a homage to Dylan Thomas was performed at the Globe Theatre with Richard Burton as the first voice. This was broadcast by the BBC and also issued as a commercial recording. All the participants waived their rights for the benefit of Dylan's widow and children. What Cleverdon failed directly to mention in his book, however, was that, after the play became a runaway success, and before Kathleen took him to court, he had sold the manuscript of Under Milk Wood to the Times Publishing Company for £2,000, a tidy sum at the time. The manuscript surfaced again at the Phoenix Bookshop, a popular haunt of poets, in New York's Greenwich Village, where it was pounced upon by the Rosenbach, a rare book library in Philadelphia. Now safely housed, Under Milk Wood is in good company, for the original manuscript of James Joyce's Ulysses also lodges there. The townspeople, created by Thomas's vivid imagination, were captured, however, for all time, in the mesmerizing cadences of Richard Burton's performance.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black, the cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbit's wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black fishing boat bobbing sea. The houses are blind as moles, though moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now. Hush! The babies are sleeping. The farmers, the fishers, the tradesmen and pensioners, cobblers, schoolteacher, postman and publican, the undertaker and the fancy woman, drunkard, dressmaker, preacher, policeman, the webfoot, cockle women, and the tidy wives. Young girls like this.
Mr. and Mrs. Cherry Owen, in the Donkey Street room that is bedroom, parlour, kitchen, and scullery, sit down to last night's supper of onions boiled in their overcoats and broth of spuds and bacon rind and leeks and bones. See that smudge on the wall by the picture of Auntie Blossom? That's where you threw the sago. You only missed me by an inch. I always miss Auntie Blossom too. Remember last night? In you reeled my boy as drunk as a deacon with a big wet bucket and a fish frail full of stout, and who looked at me and who said, God has come home, you said. And then over the bucket you went sprawling and bawling, and the floor was all flagons and eels. Was I wounded? And then you took off your trousers and you said, does anyone even want to fight? Oh, you old baboon. Kiss a kiss. And then you sang Bread of Heaven, tenor and bass. I always sing Bread of Heaven. And then you did a little dance on the table. I did. Drop dead. And then what did I do? Then you cried like a baby and said you were a poor drunk orphan with nowhere to go but the grave. And what did I do next, dear? Then you danced on the table all over again and said you were King Solomon Owen and I was your Mrs. Sheba. And then I got you into bed and you snored all night like a brewery.
It's a freezing winter's night in the dying days of the 20th century, and I'm walking with my husband through the icy streets of St. Petersburg. Swathed in scarves and appropriately hatted and gloved, all on the advice of the smiley Brendan O'Carroll lookalike barman in our hotel, it's from that hotel, situated close to St. Isaac's Cathedral, that we've just set out on this late November evening. The historic Astoria, nowadays a luxury jewel in the Rocco Forte portfolio, was a rather faded glory hotel back then, but was where I was determined to stay simply because of its connection with the American journalist John Reed. For it was here that Reed was resident when revolution came to the streets of St. Petersburg, then called Petrograd, in October 1917, prompting him to write 10 Days That Shook the World, his eyewitness account of that cataclysmic time. Can't quite place John Reed? Think Warren Beatty in the 1980s film Reds. So now, at the tail end of that seismic century, here we are walking the selfsame streets. Just a stone's throw from the majestic Winter Palace, stormed by the Bolsheviks in 1917, we're strolling now through St. Isaac's Square. And then, crossing the bridge over the ice-bound River Moika, on and on we trundle through the winter-dark streetscape of this beautiful city, located only 800 kilometres south of the Arctic Circle. So yes, it's cold. Very cold, that is. And exhibited all too clearly by our exhaled breath as it delivers little visible puffs into the night air, while my husband's moustache throws off tiny icicles every time he starts to speak. Undeterred by the cold, we face on, for we're bound for the Mussorgsky Theatre, now the Mikhailovsky, for a performance of Boris Godunov, the opera written around 1870 by none other than Mussorgsky himself. Sure, what could be better, we think, than a Russian opera when you find yourself in Russia? We are opera virgins, though, on this particular night back in 1999. This Boris Godunov performance will, in fact, be our very first night at the opera. Any opera. Ever. Are we excited? Are we what? We've read about Mussorgsky, we've boned up on the plot, and we've listened to a CD recording to get a feel for the music. And now, having tramped across the city by virtually skating along ice-white pavements, we're nearly there, ready to take our seats in this lovely old theatre and let it all just wash over us. Little do we know then, but this is the start of something, of a travel ritual that will bring us over the coming years to opera houses all over Europe, to the magnificent Staatsoper in Vienna to see Bellini's La Sonnambula, to the stunning modern Bastille Opera House in Paris for Tosca, to Zurich for Mozart's Idomeneo, to Warsaw for La Forza del Destino, and to La Fenice in Venice, so many times, first for La Traviata, and then, over the years, for many other operatic gems. Ah, but also back in the early days of our operatic love affair, there was our long weekend trip to Tallinn. And so off we went to that city's huge Art Deco opera house to see Verdi's Nabucco. How on earth could I forget Tallinn? Not having done our homework in advance for once, we were nonetheless confident, cocky even, that the surtitles displayed either side of the stage would keep us right on the storyline while we basked in the music. We'd be grand, we decided. Except we weren't. Sung, naturally, in the composer's native Italian, the surtitles for Nabucco were presented in, well, Estonian. Of course they were, and how stupid were we to expect them in English? Thank goodness, then, for Nabucco's instantly recognisable Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves, for, that aside, we were definitely completely at sea on the night in question. Back, though, to where it all began for me, to St. Petersburg. As we got closer and closer to the Mussorgsky that night, the pavements became thronged with people and we fell into step with all the men, women and children, lots of children, walking our way, until finally, like a human tsunami, We all surged through the doors of the opera house and into its welcoming warmth. Looking around the foyer as we raised a glass of pre-performance Russian champagne, it was obvious that this was just a regular night out for the locals, like going to the cinema. There was nothing whatsoever elitist for them about spending a night at the opera, which is just as it should be. For with its popular culture history, what opera offers is every aspect, every emotion of day-to-day life. Happiness, heartbreak, hate, revenge, love, jealousy. They're all there. It's the universality of the stories that do it for me. For who hasn't known a woman abandoned for a younger lover, like Norma in the Bellini opera that bears her name? Or parents whose son's choice of partner doesn't please them one bit, just like Alfredo in La Traviata? Opera? Sure, it's soap opera with posh frocks. From overture to final curtain, it's Emmerdale with arias. I can still recall so vividly that long-ago winter's night in St. Petersburg. And as we strolled slowly back to the Astoria, crossing bridge after bridge over white frosted canals and rivers, the magical sound of the night's opera was still ringing in my ears. All these decades later, it's ringing still.
Of course they come back, the dead, because they are there, just beyond the reach of our material being, on the other side of that nothingness we are scared of. The dead have their own work to do, on earth and throughout the heavens. And they are there, too, because we keep haunting them. They are still alive in us. We need them, as we hunger for hope and meaning. The new God that our age holds to is not the Most High and Almighty God. He is burning bush and whinny hill and furze bloom. He is no longer a gilt tabernacle bathed in ethereal light, but he is there too alongside our dead. He is Goldcrest flitting in the Berberus. He is the small flock of sparrows bathing in the pool left along the potholes in our country roads. And that is why, remembering the days when the pink rose rambled, when blackberries plashed purple kisses on my lips, I can still find contentment this side of nothingness, because I, too, am ghosted by the presence of those I have loved and lost. Father, for instance, who came for the first time to the island and took up fishing from the high rocks beyond Purchin. After a long day's work, suffered in an airless and paper-ridden office, he was happy to escape into the free and bewildering air there at the rim of the world. He stood, late evenings, stirred by the wonder of the Atlantic, awed by the teeming life of the ocean. I, then still unthought of, am there too, on the cliff ledge near him, waiting. They did not yet know each other, but there was Mother, native to the island, picnicking with her sister Patricia on the strand. I see them sitting on a tartan-printed blanket laid out on the sand. There is a basket of sandwiches, a bottle of rose-red wine, and some Waterford cut-glass tumblers. They are laughing together, youth and promise, copious as the blue sky above them. I am there too, as yet unthought of, watching from the breaking waves, and waiting. And now all three of them are ghosts. They have become island, having touched all boundaries and frontiers, all shores, and gone beyond them. Their bodies have become clay, dust of original stardust, their spirits part of the eternal spirit that is brooding over all islands, over the all clay of our being, over the every soul of creation. Patricia died, aged 24, from the dreaded consumption, and I was scarcely 2 months old. But she, my gentle and beautiful godmother, haunts me still. I keep a shard of the most pure, the whitest quartz, filched from her grave, and it holds me to her, though we scarcely met at the difficult junction into, out of time. When I came upon her photograph, the date in mother's teacherly hand underneath, I felt a sense of loss again and of defeat. 1939, that century's monstrous war machines already turning, Patricia, aunt and godmother, barely 19, in studio pose, a flawless loveliness, the flaw lurking within. She was gazing out at us from the picture, assured, looking to some certain and future promise. My now, her then, coming together in this moment's Eucharist. Aware, perhaps too early, that our human dreams are clouds, this earth, our cherished place, a moment's sunlight, a long dark. And so I sought and seek the words that will undo time. She alive again, resplendent in memory, where a life long gone remains whole in its promise and undefeated. She and I, compacted of island stone, sea and sky, bones of the spirit and pores of the body, the ongoing flood of imperatives, the tempests of sorrow, the peaceable kingdom. And after her, father left for the worlds beyond our mortal being, and mother too. Though each of them, long gone into that world of light, leave strong and varying glimmers in the memory, and a haunting presence in their son of love and faithfulness. So I have stood at the sea's edge, stunned again at the knowledge of my own ageing, father, mother, Patricia, decades gone into that ocean of all unknowing. And since time itself is not real, since it is merely a figment of our imagining, so that then is now, now then, I call to them from this wind-blown strand, bracing myself against the power of evolution and cosmos, and call out to them, watching for them still. And the rain comes slanting down and vanishing into the heaving sea, and the myriads of raindrops in their perfection and in their beauty meld with the waves of the ocean and with its breakers.
On this morning's programme, a mix of new and recent archive scripts, we heard Not Walking with Kofi by Georg Grote, November Dead List by Louise Kennedy, Trying to Remember was by Beth Kilkenny, Dylan Thomas's Lost Manuscript was by Justin McCarthy, Opera Nights by Rosalind D, and Then and Now by John F. Dean. The music today was An Gui an Iar an As, arranged and performed by Ronan Brown on Illan Pipes and Pather O'Loughlin on Fiddle. Kashmiri Love Song, composed by Amy Woodford Findon, with Julian Lloyd Webber on cello and with John Linehan on piano. Sea of Love by John Fahey. From Dylan Thomas's Milkwood, Mr. and Mrs. Cherry Owen, performed by Keris Matthews, and before that, Richard Burton's recording of the opening of that play. And the last piece was Verdi's Chorus of the Hebrew Slaves, in a version from the soundtrack to the film Maria. The conductor was Peter Ilenyi. A lot of this morning's writers are included in the latest Sunday Miscellany anthology, which has just been released. Sunday Miscellany, a Selection 2023 to 2025, is published by New Island Books, and it's up for an Irish Book Award. The nomination is in the category thejournal.ie Best Irish Published Book. You can find out more about that and vote for us, if you like, at irishbookawards.ie. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator this morning was Mary Elizabeth Bruton, and the producer is Sarah Binchy.